Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Recorded live in California, USA, it's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the show that loves big, likes pop, and has fun. Now, from the Wilson World Studios, here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Big Pop Fun podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson. Yeah, I know. Sorry. But welcome to another episode. If you haven't listened to the podcast, welcome to the podcast. Go backwards and forwards and download all of them, and I hope you enjoy yourself. If you've listened to a whole bunch of them, welcome. Welcome back to another magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder, as we frolic across cotton candy hillsides of happy pastels, drawing us ever closer to our true selves, unencumbered by worries of gas prices or expensive dentistry. Man, hard to get away from them, huh? Anyway, it's brought to you by TomWilsonUSA.com, my website, where it's live performing and stuff. You can contact me through that. BigPopFun.com, my paintings. It's always brought to you by art. Support the arts. Buy art. It's brought to you by RalphNelson.com. Ralph was a guest on several podcasts ago. It's interesting, if you haven't listened, I know the fabulous science fiction writer Ray Bradbury passed away, and Ralph has published many wonderful photographs that he took of Ray Bradbury. Ralph was a friend of Ray Bradbury's, a confidant of his, and it's always Ralph has added fascinating life. And listen to that podcast or check out RalphNelson.com, where he, talks about Ray Bradbury and has some of the photographs he took of Ray. How's that for promoting just a friend of mine who has a website himself? Because what did I do last week? Last week I just promoted things that are around me. I could promote something that brought to you by the sheet music for the song "American Pie" by Don McLean. This "American Pie," a song that Tom once tried to memorize a long time ago and hasn't, and the sheet music is still in his office. And as the flames climbed high into the night to light the sacrificial rite, I saw, well, never mind. But that was the day the music died. But my podcast is still alive. So let's take a stroll down to Comedy Corner. Boy, the last number of podcasts we've talked about early comedy, haven't we? Let's take a stroll down to Comedy Corner. Well, Tom will tell you another only marginally interesting story of stand-up days of yore. Stand-up has become an image in people's minds now. People think they know what it is. Stand-up years and years ago was a very, very unusual thing to go and see, but to perform it, you had to be crazy. And now if you say, well, I do stand-up comedy, people say, oh, yeah, my uncle does that, and my cousin Rick does that. So, but people have an idea of what it is, the guy or the girl or the lady or the man, I don't know, the person, how's that, in front of the brick wall talking about life and things he or she has observed. And that is a lot of stand-up. It's a lot of stand-up. The person who, hey, I noticed these things and I want to share them as I stand in front of this brick wall. But when I was going around to clubs trying to figure it all out decades ago, the guys trying to figure it out along with me, we're doing it in many different ways. And, I mean, I've told you some of them. I told you the Dennis Miller thing or Bob Saget about My Guitar Gently Weeps. But there was a guy who had an eating act. I forget what his name was. But he would set up a card table with a meal on it. And this was his act, to music. He would spread his napkin out and he would eat the whole meal. But then he would eat the hard-boiled egg and the shell. Then he would eat all the salt on the table. Then he would eat the napkin, the plate, the bones. That was his act, just eating stuff to music. And he did it at comedy clubs and discos on Thursday night or open mics. all that kind of stuff. I mean, when I first came to L.A., Michael Richards was doing a lot of performing. And Michael Richards, you can't say that what he does or did, I'm not sure if he's out there, I haven't seen him for a little while now, but what he did was stand up. He did very odd theater pieces, as you know, surprise, surprise. But I remember when I was out there, Michael Richards and I think it was Ed Begley Jr. brought a table out, brought like a dining room table out to the stage of the Comedy Store, and they had silent movie music playing over the sound system, and it was, and they just took out saws and they just sawed the table up. So, and that was their act. We just sawed up a table, and that was what it was. And well, Michael Richards did many. We'll talk about Michael Richards on another episode because that's kind of a long thing. But I worked with him at the Westwood Comedy Store many, many nights where he was there very late, disassembling the booths while people were sitting in them, and then just going out into the street so everyone could hear him just screaming at the top of his lungs for the police. Yeah, it was very unusual, but my point is that's what it was. We had a lot of unusual people doing some stuff. As I said, I did many unusual things, play the tuba in my act or using the props that people that had, you know, look, anything to get noticed, to be funny, to get gigs and to make money. So, look, the purest comics were always, you know, driving dad's car to the gig, and they had money from somewhere to buy food and gas, and they could just observe things and work jokes. Look, the desperate guys like me were just riding the train and using anything that would work to get $20 and a meal. So it was just, you know, whatever would go over. All right, didn't mean to get on a, oh, brother, where art thou? Tangent there, but my point is there was a lot of creativity going on, and I liked it. I thought it was really interesting. And though he wasn't a part of comedy that long ago, Heath Heitch has always impressed me as a guy creative and searching for new and different ways to entertain an audience. As I said, he wasn't a comedian back then. He's a younger guy, but he's a stand-up comedian, but he doesn't stand in front of a brick wall saying that he noticed things. You ever notice how cheese is? But with his tools and his music and his set pieces, he builds sets, he acts pieces out. I think Heath is a very theatrical comedian. He is a stand-up comedian. But mostly, I would say he does funny theater. He's a theatrical entertainer. He's a great guy. And though he might seem like an opposite, like a polar opposite, Heath is a great friend of the my guest a couple podcasts ago, Fred Stoller. So listen to the Fred Stoller podcast and listen to this one. These guys are very good buddies, which is the wonderful part about the comedy world. Please, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Heath Heitch.
It's Big Pop Fun.
So, Heath, we are continuing our podcast-a-thon.
Right.
Because you were kind enough to extend an invitation for me to come to your place.
Of course.
Because my friend Fred Stoller has several thousand cats, apparently.
I know.
He's a hoarder of some
kind.
He has
some cat problems.
Stacks of old New York Daily News and cats. So I could do it. But it's kind of you to have me. And thanks.
Yeah. No, this is my first podcast. I'm a podcast virgin, so I'm very excited.
I guess I'll put Fred's on first because, I mean, to the podcast.
Great.
Before yours, so we can, if that stuff comes up, people will understand what we're talking about.
Right.
And if you haven't listened to the Fred Stoller interview, I strongly recommend
it was great.
That you go back to iTunes and download that one. But we'll get to where you're from and everything.
Right.
But how are you and Fred friends?
Fred Stoller and I met years ago, probably, I guess it was 10, 11 years ago. There was a movie of the week that Cameron Manheim produced, and it was Cyrano de Bergerac story of a comedian, a hot girl who was only hot, but Cameron Manheim was the bartender at the comedy club and would write her material and teach her how to say it, Cyrano de Bergerac. And so she became this wonderful comedian, but the voice of comedy was really from Cameron Manheim. And she gets onto the Montreal, the Aspen Comedy Festival at the time. And she has no material, but then the guy that books her on this thing is really in love with her, but we find out he's in love with her material, so he actually falls for Cameron Manheim, the bartender, because she's so funny. Made no sense, but they
that
wanted
happens
some,
every
I know,
day.
They wanted comics. They wanted comics to surround the bar. And so Fred and I show up, and I was like, oh, I recognize Fred, and we meet each other. Okay, there's a goofy prop guy. That's me. There's a nerdy – they actually put in the description, nerd comic gets ticket was a scene. And Fred said, I guess I'm working that day. And they had one guy that was kind of a really crazy – Pablo Francisco was with it, and he was like the crazy guy. And we all floated around the bar and were the kind of glorified extras with more lines. And as Fred has said before, we thought 3 weeks in Canada is going to be great because we have a few scenes. Mm-hmm. Turns out we're really extras throughout the whole movie. We have our scenes, but they want us
just
on
there.
Camera
right.
the entire time. And the first day of shooting, Fred and I meet and we're talking, we're having some good laughs, and we're ushered into this back room of a fake bar at a brewery that's set up to look like a comedy club. There's nothing around. We're in the middle of Montreal with nothing going on. And they say, okay, you two come in. You're talking. No voices. No audio at all. Just looking at each other. Very miming acting. Go sit at this table and get ready. And as the guy walks out, Fred turns to me and says, 3 weeks of this like that. And then I said, this is my friend. And we would sit for the 3 weeks in a bar scene acting like
background artists, quote
stuck.
Unquote.
Yes.
Which is many people do it very well, and they actually make a living doing that.
Right.
But most actors or creative people, it begins to drive them absolutely insane within 4 minutes.
Right.
Because you're just sitting at a table staring at each other, pretending to talk.
I know, and it drove when I first experienced background actor, and I have all the respect because they make it look real. They really do. They make scenes, and I'm not saying I would demeaning of any type of choice.
No, I lack the respect that you have, and I mean it in a demeaning way. But we're at the same page as far as the artistry.
Yes, the artistry
goes.
Of trying to make a buck. That's all I'm saying. I did a show, a sitcom, and they said, this is the bullpen, you know, where we have the little office.
Right.
And I'm sitting at my little desk. I was a regular on this show, and I'm sitting at my desk in the bullpen, and we've rehearsed. This is my first kind of big show in Hollywood. We've rehearsed for weeks, and they said there'll be other people, you know, on shoot day, we'll have other people that work here, fictitiously work here, that are coming in and out of the office space. So we never rehearse with these people, and then they bring in the background actors. We all set up, and they say, okay, let's get it going. The studio audience is in. They say, background, and these people start walking around. And I'm sitting at my desk, and a gentleman comes up to me and looks at me and starts moving his mouth as we're shooting. I have never seen this. This is my first real kind of show like this. And as we're filming, and I'm back a ways from the camera, I say, what? And he mimics something again, and I go, what? And I'm just staring at this guy like, what are you doing? And he asks me again, and he points at my desk and mimes speaking. So I look at my desk, and there's a Post-it thing. And I peel up the Post-it and hand it to the guy, and he nods his head and walks off. Yeah. So I go, perfect. Another lady approaches my desk, mimicking talking. I pull off another Post-it. I hand it to her. She walks off. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we're going to have to get more Post-its.
You were an actor in the scene?
I was an actor. I was a series regular.
What happens sometimes – now, handing someone a Post-it generally doesn't happen. But the fact is, certainly on feature films, if a background artist comes up to you as an actor in the scene – and does a piece of business with you, it could even be shaking your hand. They can get a bump. They can actually get a $10 bonus, a $20 bonus.
Right.
They will be around, and their thinking is, if I'm there, if he hands me the Post-it, maybe in a shot in the future, the director will say, and Ted, why don't you just say thanks for the Post-it and then walk off, and then I'll get in the union.
Then you're in the union.
Then I'm in the union.
Well, I'm on T-shirts for the Union of Background Actors. They have me like,
good.
I'm handing a Post-it.
Yeah. The Post-it note hander. you could be giving out $10 bills. Yeah. I mean, as much as Post-its. But that really is. Sometimes in a movie, you have to really fight all of these people who are trying to engage with you
right.
as you're walking through the office or down the hallway because they're trying to get in the scene.
Right. Get it.
They think the director might say, hey, while he walks down the hallway, why don't you just say, good morning, Mr. Johnson, because the sun is coming through. Yes, I'm saying good morning, Mr. Johnson. That kind of thing. And not that I don't want people to say that. As you know, you were an actor in the scene. Not that I don't want people to get $10. Not that I don't want to help everyone, because I do. But they really want to do that over your need to actually get the real lines of the scene out.
And you've been up all night running these lines and these the changes, and they're just thinking.
Exactly. And they just changed the bottom half of the speech you have to give at the end of the hallway.
Yeah.
They said, you know, the second, once you say, so now that we're together, don't do that, but do the rest of the scene, and then do that now that we're together at the back of the scene.
Yes, exactly.
So you have, your brain is going, in the back of your head as you're walking down the hallway trying to remember what they just told you.
Right.
And a lady's walking up to shake your hand and take a Post-it note.
Yes.
I just go on, dear, if you'd be so kind,
yeah.
I really can't hand you a Post-it note right now. I'd really rather not, because I really, I'm thinking of a lot of things.
And now on her podcast, she goes, that Tom guy, he is a jerk.
What a jerk. I wanted,
let me tell you a story about him.
He stopped giving out Post-it notes. We all hate him. But as you know, that happens. But I just thought it was, we're here at your house.
Right.
And Fred, you guys are very good friends, and that's wonderful. But at first glance, it would be an illogical pairing of guys.
Absolutely. Well, we were trapped in Canada together.
Yeah.
And we hung out, had a great time, and we would have maybe 11-hour days where we would shoot for 20 minutes. You know how that is. And
sure.
You would not be needed, but they wanted you on set. So there were no place to go, no place to run and do things, nothing except sit in a trailer. So we would go to the local video store before we went, and we would rent all these movies. He'd say, have you seen Run, Lola, Run? No, I've not seen that. So we'd get that. He said, have you seen Carlito's Way? I said, no, I haven't seen. So we would watch these movies on a tiny little trailer thing. It was fun, and we just became friends there. And
we both like toys.
Yeah, we enjoyed.
Oh, you're your toy guys?
Yeah, totally. I've been collecting since I was a child, and he's
and then Fred's a toy collector guy?
I think so, yeah.
Are you,
yeah.
Fred?
Yeah, I'm trying not to be the 40-year-old virgin, so I've given a lot of tell the story about
we've got a director now. This is good.
Oh, yeah, just walking around Canada with Fred. And I said, okay, if we can save money on our per diem. They give you per diem.
Sure, a little bit of money every day to eat.
Right. If you get on this train, take it to the second stop, jump off that, we'll get on the N train, go up. And then if we jump off that, we can walk two blocks to another tram. The tram is actually free on Tuesdays. We can ride and he goes, oh, screw this, I'm paying for a taxi. Was like, is it, you know, this thing? Like, I'm
oh, New York. Just get me a cab.
Yeah, just get me there.
If it costs $7,000, I'm not changing three
okay,
it's buses.
Your per diem, not mine.
Exactly.
Just let us know.
Exactly. So we've known each other a little bit, Heath, but mostly I met you on the walls of nightclubs.
That's great. Yeah, me too. That's
yeah, because I would be performing at one of the improvs around the country or some big club, and there's a big picture of Jerry Seinfeld, and there's a big picture of whomever, Fred Stoller or anyone, big comedians of the day, and there is a big picture of a great, handsome, clean-cut guy, smiling huge, with all kinds of mannequins and things.
It's a giant choir.
A giant choir behind you that is set up kind of on your
backpack,
shoulders.
Right.
So I would say, well, who is this? Well, that's Heath Heitch.
Yeah.
Wow, and what does he do? Well, he sings with an entire gospel choir
strapped
to his back on his shoulder. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you have to see it. It's great. So then we finally meet.
Can I tell you one thing about that?
Sure, of course.
I don't mean to interrupt, but with that picture, that's my closer. And I say, could you mind taking that down when I'm here this week? Because I don't see Dom Herrera's closing joke written on the walls anywhere.
Exactly. You know, exactly.
So that was just
so they would have it on the wall.
Yeah, and I go, you got to cover that up, because they're going to go, oh, that's the guy we're seeing. Oh, and he's going to pull this
eventually
out.
Eventually, he's going to pull out a gigantic gospel choir and
strap
it
to his
back.
So anyway, go ahead.
So then I finally meet you, Heath. And I'll tell you,
It was troubling.
Oh, good.
It was troubling. Because it was very odd for me to meet a guy who is actually more clean cut, more positive and excited about living, more all of those things, better looking, probably took a longer shower than I did, in one guy that actually is nicer and more all American than I am. And
right.
I was very troubled by that.
Well, I'll give you a Post-it T-shirt when you leave, and then you can.
But I think we are. You grew up in the South, though.
I did.
No, I grew up in Philadelphia.
Birmingham. Birmingham, Alabama.
Birmingham, Alabama.
Right. I have a sister, and I was the guy in the basement that Halloween was my favorite. I was building stuff year-round to make a haunted house in our basement for
really?
When I was 10 years old. You know, I was putting on Christmas plays with my entire family, with my two cousins, all girls, my two cousins and my sister. And I would say, I'm Santa Claus. And I would write these plays from October to December. I'd build all the props, build the costumes. You know,
You weren't in sports or anything.
I was. You did everything. I was. Well, growing up in Alabama and saying, I've got to go rehearse a song and dance number is what you really want to hear.
Not the best. Yeah.
Let's put him in a truck.
You get a lot of that.
Yeah.
But I did play football. I played just a little bit. I was tiny, though, Tom. When I was in high school, I was 4'9" when I got in high school. So I was – did you see the movie Lucas? Remember that?
Sure.
That was me in high school. I played football, and I was tiny. They didn't have pads to fit me. We had to have special pads, and I wanted to be a football player was my goal, my dream.
So ninth grade, 4'9".
4'9". Tried out for the – and I was always being funny, and the girls were – you know, I didn't hit puberty till like I was almost a junior.
Yeah.
And the girls were like, oh, he's so cute. And the players were like, he's so adorable. And they
– just you could just hold him.
And it would be –
I am just –
and I would be in pads. I was tiny. And all the football players, they'd go, all right, now, Little Heath. That's what they call me, Little Heath. And I just had a heart that couldn't stop. I said, I'm going to be a starting football player. That's what I'm supposed to be.
Uh-huh.
And just played and practiced in freshman football. JV comes along. I'm like, I'm going to do this. I start going through the varsity tryouts. And I'm still tiny. And I remember the day the coach stopped me and he said, Heath, let me tell you something. He said, if I could take your heart, and he picked out this guy named Chris, this huge guy, he goes, and put it in his body, I'd have one hell of a football player. But right now, I never cut anybody. But I'm letting you know, if I had to cut people, I'd have to put you on, not for your heart, because of your size. Because I don't want you coming to practice all the time and then sitting on the bench for 2 years. He goes, you're not going to play. But I really, really want you to know that now, because you have a heart that this blows me away. And I was like, okay. I turned my pads in that week. It was like that procession walking through the players, taking it out of the – it's almost like an 80s
from
movie.
From the end of Rooney, yeah. Something, yeah. Clap, something like, slow, yeah. Clap. Yeah.
And I take the coach and go, I'll be back. He goes, I know you will. Never stepped foot on a football field after that. Became
that
the school
it.
Mascot,
yeah.
And then comedy ever since.
Wow.
That was it.
Now, was this an old – your family, granddad, everybody's Alabama old
yes,
time?
Yes, everybody. Everybody.
Everybody.
There was one uncle that would have the books of every transaction the Heiches made when they came overseas, and he was
this guy talk like, now look here, your great 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 grandfather, he had a trade in here. We have an actual bill of sale here where he traded 3 furs for a piece of salmon. Now that salmon fed these,
and he was so boring, no one talked to him. So he wrote this whole book. No one knows where it is, and no one knows our family history.
Really? Because the book is lost.
Yeah, the book. I guess the book is lost, or someone has it somewhere, but. He wrote this this kind of account where he would take, you know, those family members. Say, this is every picture we've ever had and all
so,
that.
And you just have your sister?
Just my sister,
just
mom
your
and
sister,
dad.
Mom and dad.
Now, right.
Dad, was dad a truck driving with the whole thing?
No, dad worked at the Social Security Administration for 20 years, hated every day of it, 25 years almost. When we got in college or almost to college, they offered early retirement. And my dad's always wanted to be, he's always loved art. And he retired and became an artist. And that's a painting here and the painting over my mantle.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful.
So my dad's been...
So your dad's a painter.
He's an artist and has lived as an artist for probably almost 20 years now, and been that's his sole income. And mom worked at the bank part-time when we were in high school, and then she quit, and she just was a mom. So my dad has been very successful as an artist. So that was great for me.
Yeah, was dad quiet about that artistic longing at the Social Security Administration? So nobody knew anything.
Well, they would say, oh, we have a party, we have this. John Heich will do the poster. he was that guy. You know, he would
just good with that, a graphic design or something.
Silly stuff like that. But he was a computer programmer back in the 70s and 80s when computer programs looked like a player piano.
With the cards and everything.
He couldn't even hook up an Atari. I'm not kidding. Like that was, but he would slide cards in a machine, like the Bat Computer in the 60s TV show.
Yeah.
And so he quit that and started working part time at a gallery, and then started painting and became this success in Birmingham. And people, it's very funny. My sister, we share stories about people saying, "Now, are you related to John Heitch, the artist?" And we just think that's so funny. Like, yeah, that's Dad. You know,
really?
Yeah.
So is your dad's work online? Can people see it?
Well, you can go to a Loretta Goodwin gallery. I think it's .com, but that's where he is. That's his kind of it's a lot different than what we do as comics, but he sticks at this gallery and then a couple of other galleries out there. But they don't have a computer. They don't. I tried to tell my dad on the phone. I said, "Look, I bought you this computer for Christmas. I can email you my flights if I'm coming home, and you can have that." And he said, "You're talking to me now." I said, "Yeah, but I can email them to you." He goes, "Tell me now."
Man, I love your dad. I want to be your dad when I grow up.
So
just chuck the computer and paint. Mm-hmm. That'd be cool.
That's what he has no desire.
So you were waiting for Halloween when you were a little kid, because you loved the show of it.
I loved the
pageantry.
I didn't know what it was. I didn't know. Tom, it went everywhere from being 8 to 9. We would play war. You know, you'd go out in the yard with army gear on, and people would get guns for Chris, plastic machine guns. Mm-hmm. They would bring them to my house because I would distress them and paint them and add stuff to them prop-wise to make them look like, you know, a real sniper rifle. So we would make these rifles look real. Like I remember, you may have even had one, the little fake bolt action M1.
Sure.
It had the little plastic bullet in it. I would take that and take Band-Aid boxes, the metal ones. Back in the day, they used to be metal. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Paint them black and use them as magazines and hook them to where they would hook on the bottom of it so I could be storming the beaches of
Omaha. Nothing was better than when America had a bunch of just kids running through neighborhoods with completely authentic looking war implements.
Well, we did.
No, the test of a gun was just how real it looked.
Right.
It just was like, if that looks like something that an army guy would kill people with,
you're good.
That's cool, man.
I know.
I'm using that.
We'd make hand grenades and stuff like that, and you would. It was so much fun. It was some of the most fun I've ever had. But we would do that. I had the authentic army helmet. That's what I saved up my allowance to do, was to go to the Army Navy store at 8, 9, 10, 11 years old and buy gear. We called it camo. You know, you wanted to be as authentic as you could to play. We called it army. He said, "Let's play army. Play army. And just go out there and build bases and in the woods."
So, and that just grew with you. I mean, it seems like you never stopped.
I haven't.
It changed into a different thing. Now you're in high school and you're no longer playing football.
I become the school mascot.
You're smaller. Are the school mascot. Did you have the big head on? Or
this is funny. We were the Huffman Vikings in Birmingham. Well, you would think it was the Huffman Vikings would be a Viking mascot. It was on the posters and all of the logos, but our school started in the 70s, and the colors were very 70s colors. They were like green and orange, much like the Miami Hurricanes with our color scheme. And so they would say, "Go big green, go big orange." So someone came up with the idea of doing a big orange as the mascot, kind of the silly hippie.
Couldn't even be a Viking.
Not a Viking, Tom. I was an orange, and I had a chicken wire orange that was from the neck. My face was exposed. My head was exposed. It was just a chicken wire orange covered in an orange fabric, and you had armholes, and not even like the Syracuse orange guy where his head is covered, the orange man. It was
you were an orange.
And you would go out, and we had a sun kiss stencil on it, and I would go to football games and be with the cheerleaders. That was the thing. I figured it out. While they're playing football, I'm hanging out with the cheerleaders.
You're talking to girls, yeah.
Right.
That's a big orange, nonetheless.
I'm in an orange costume, but look at what I'm working with in my face. I'm kidding. So and I did this, and I would throw candy in the crowds, and then every Friday we had a pep rally, and I would get to do a sketch in front of the entire student body. And I would rally them, and I would do things from an Indiana Jones sketch where I would dress up and build props all week, so excited to perform for the student body. And I would do this, and they would have a sound system, and I would dress up like Inspector Clouseau one week because we played a team that I was going to be – they were trying to rob a bank in the middle of the gymnasium floor. And, you know, they had a little
so you
sketch.
Wrote the sketches.
Wrote them,
you
built everything.
You cast friends as actors in the sketches.
And they were always like, dude, could you get me out of math? Seriously, get me out of math class. I'll come
home. Oh, because if you had to rehearse for the pep rally.
Yeah, you come out.
You got out of class.
Yeah. And that's what I did. And everyone was like, wow. So this leads on. I say, well, what do I do now? I'm a senior. I didn't do theater in college because our theater department was a little.
So you went to college and didn't, and that there was a break. You were no longer in Orange.
Right.
You went to where'd you go to college?
I went to Auburn University.
Oh, Auburn.
Yeah, so I'm a huge Auburn fan. But
you were not an Orange Tiger. You were nothing.
No, but that's the thing is I went to do that. I said, I know what I'll do. I'll leave high school. I did the junior college for one half year, which was, we called it 13th grade.
Yeah, sure.
I did that, got my grades better, and I said, okay, I'm going to, and took a theater class in college, which I'd never done. And I had never been in any type of line memorization except what I had written with the Santa Claus plays and the haunted house material or the sketches I'd done. And the first day of theater class at this Chinese junior college, the teacher comes and goes, all right, we're going to do Oedipus Rex. And I go, is that a dinosaur? What is that?
Yeah,
I have no idea. So that was my throw into theater.
Right.
And I did that. I was like, okay, it's stage. It's really cool. I want to transfer to Auburn. I say, I'm going to be Aubie, the school mascot, which is the tiger. And you're in front of the entire football stadium.
Yes.
I got there. I enrolled in the acting department there, the theater department there. And the first day in a real theater department like that, you realize you have no time. You have no time to do. You're going to be rehearsing or in costume construction or in set construction.
Right.
Because they divvied up responsibilities. If, Tom, you're not acting this quarter, you're going to be in charge of building the sets.
Building sets, setting up the lighting, doing everything.
Yeah, so you learn everything.
It's like a medical school.
It is.
Where you just make interns do everything.
Right.
Whatever. If you want to learn this, then you're our slave.
Right. Totally. And that, you're a slave. You're a slave to the whole theater department. And I said, I have no time to do that. And then I was bit by the acting bug is... Mm-hmm. That's silly cliche, but that's how I started.
So you worked through Auburn in the theater department.
Yes.
What's your degree in there?
Theater, Bachelor of Fine Arts.
BFA in
BFA
theater.
Theater.
Wow, fancy schmancy.
Yeah, yes.
And you get out, and did you do theater after that?
No, it was very funny because a quick side story to this. I was in theater, and we had, as you are, when we're on stage, we also do kind of a character-y thing, I think. Like when you do your
– Oh, you mean it's stand-up?
Stand-up,
yeah.
Right. And I was doing that, but not knowing how it could lead into stand-up at the time.
You were doing that, you mean?
In my performances on stage. When I would do a play in college, if I got to be one of the goofy characters in the play, I was so thrilled because I got to show off. I got to get the laughs, if you will. And I do this thing, and they have things people called adjudicators who would come to universities and watch a production from an outside, a third party, and say, Romeo and Juliet was great. Let me ask you a couple of questions. These actors were exceptional. These guys, I think you could work on this. And so we did She Stoops to Conquer, which was and I played Diggory the butler, which was a tiny, tiny role.
Very funny role.
But it's like a Tim Conway role, basically.
Yep.
And they turned the theater in Auburn into a turn-of-the-century theater and had footlights that I got to come out as a pre-show and light and interact with the audience to set them like we're in an old theater.
Right.
And it was like my first improv. And I just started throwing at people like, oh, look at this gentleman here, you know, doing these character pieces with a
just
guy.
Just working the crowd.
Huge laughs, so much so the director's like, you got to cut down the funny in the opening because we're not funny enough on stage. You know, it's capping in the middle.
Yeah.
So this adjudicator says, you were great, and he nominated me for what they called an Irene Ryan Award, which Irene Ryan was Granny.
Granny in the Beverly Hillbillies, absolutely.
And if you did that, you were picked. There were eight regions, I think, in the Southeast, Northeast, all this, and there were hundreds of kids picked, and for good performances in productions, and then you went and performed a piece as like almost like a stand up or a round robin of acting pieces, and you were given I think 4 or 5 minutes, and you had to do two pieces if you wanted. So I didn't have anything I wanted to do, and I told my acting coach, "What if I write something?" He was great. Write it. And I wrote this silly piece of just me being a goofy guy, and I kept getting passed through, and I won my region. And they flew me to Washington, D.C. to compete in the Nationals. And I'm just like, what? And Jason Robarts was the MC.
Wow.
And he comes up, and my piece was basically a part I wrote like, hey, I just want to be famous, which is the whole opposite thing of being in theater.
Of course,
yeah. Love there. I said, I don't care about this. I want to be on a movie where I'm fighting. I'm an airplane in a dogfight. I want to be a swashbuckling hero. And I did this imaginative piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you know who Uta Hagen is. Uta Hagen is this great acting coach. She was there and watched.
Really?
We had to go to acting class with Uta Hagen.
Well, people should know who are listening. And Uta, she wrote the book Respect for Acting.
Yes.
She was she's just a seminal actor in New York City.
Yes.
In really the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, HB Studios, a teacher for many years. At the pinnacle of theater actresses in America.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's great. And she taught an acting class that we had to go to, and everyone's scared to death. It's like standing in with Dr. Frankenstein. And there's 18 of us from across the country that have come. And I do my piece where I actually jumped on the back of a chair, and the first day of class, she goes, the Irene Ryan auditions were abysmal. Who stands on chairs? And I was just like sinking. Like, oh, my God. So that was my... Then I graduate, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
but who stands on chairs?
No, but they're awful. She had a puppy, like a poodle, yes, under one arm, and yeah, a cigarette in it.
Of course, she did.
Yeah, it was perfect.
She's the perfect yes, acting teacher.
Yes. So that was my little Irene Ryan story.
But
I didn't win, you know.
But who won?
I don't even remember.
No
right.
one knows.
No one knows. No one knows.
No
perfect.
One knows.
Yes.
People
yes.
know Heath Heitch.
Nicolas Cage?
No. I'm kidding. In my opinion, I think if you want, you know, hey, kids,
yeah,
stand on a chair.
Right. I know.
Because if you wait around, all due respect to Uta Hagen.
Yes.
If you wait around for the lady with the poodle and the cigarette to say, yeah, I approve of what you just
did.
You just go home,
right,
because you're not going to be. You better get up there and stand on a chair.
Yes.
And if she says, get off the chair, tell her, you don't know what you're talking about. This is my chair.
Yes.
So
it's like rock and roll in the 50s. I don't care what you say. These kids love it. Turn it up.
Right. Just turn it up and do it.
Yeah.
Do it. And anyone who says you don't know what you're doing, they don't know what they're talking about.
I know. It's
you don't know what you're doing for them.
Right. Oh, that's brilliant. I like that. That's really good.
So you left there. What did that? I mean, Uta Hagen tells you that. Like, really, the comic sensibility within you,
right,
is absolutely expressing itself on stage.
Right.
And you are, as I was.
Yes.
When you're a young man.
Uh-huh.
You're full of energy and passion for this. And you are just kind of you are just exploding on stage.
Yes.
And of course, the lady says, you know,
wrong,
get off the chair. Wrong.
Right.
So how did you go back home that night?
It was very funny. I go back, and my teacher was ecstatic that I even got that far. He said, I'll never have anyone that in my camp, in my kids, you know, that I ever do this. He goes, this was great. He goes, you did something amazing. And I was like, well, I thought I was going to win. You know, I thought it was so original that I would win. And so I go back to Auburn, and we do another production of Romeo and Juliet. And so I say, oh, I'm going to be Romeo. I mean, I'm the youngest looking. I'm the whole thing. I audition. Tom, I'm sorry. I have to back up. During that time when I get off, I don't know what I'm going to do because that had happened, and I'm still auditioning in my theater classes. And I take some form I had to fill out and drop off at the student union at Auburn. And I walk in, and I give the form, and I hear from the theater this ruckus, like a football game. And I turn to the guy, and I go, what's happening in there? And he goes, oh, it's our comedy concert. I go, really? And he goes, yeah, Carrot Top is killing. And I say, who? He goes, oh, it's a comic named Carrot Top. I said, and I then again, hi. I go, what, can I go? He goes, oh, it's free, yeah. I'd not heard of this person. Mm-hmm. And I walk in, and I walk to the back of this room. It's packed, but it's a smaller venue because it was like 1992 is when this was. And I always say it was early in his act because they only had three trunks.
yeah.
So, and I stand at the back of the room, and it was that thing that we've all experienced as comics. When you see something that you go, wow, you don't belly laugh that much. You go, that's brilliant. I wish I had thought of that. Mm-hmm. It's like this creative jealousy.
I think it's a great thing.
Yes.
And I freely admit it with actor friends that I know, with comics that I know, that is a part of the artistic sensibility.
Yes.
That it's a wonderful thing that you are enjoying, but the fact is, in the artist, it's kind of ticking you off.
Yes.
Because you're thinking, that guy beat me to this.
Yes, that's
you
it.
Know, like,
that's
how? Oh, that's, oh, man.
And I didn't know what it was. I flash back as a kid when I'm standing there and I'm watching him and I'm literally saying, when I see him and I say, I could do this. I'm saying this in my head and I feel myself saying out loud, I could do this. I could do this. And I'm watching this crowd, every piece. And he's doing his big closer. And I go, I could do this. And I flash back when I was probably 12, I saw on PBS one of my heroes to this day, a Red Skelton from the Met. And I see Red Skelton, who is, I think, one of the greatest comic minds. I mean, he came along at a time, and he's a genius. I love watching his stuff. And I remember laughing at that when I was 12. And then when I was 18, I saw the same special, and I laughed at it when I was 18. And I said, immediately, there's something about this guy that can make a 12-year-old laugh and an 18-year-old laugh. And I don't know what that is. And then I'm seeing Carrot Top, and I'm saying, this is really interesting. And after the show, he was loading up, and people were filing out. And I walked to the stage, and I said, hey. And he was very friendly, and he said, how's it going? And I said, my name's Heath. And he said, hey, for those of you, my name's Scott, you know. And I talked to him for a second, and I said, you know, I'm really impressed with what you did. That was very inspiring. And he goes, oh, thanks, dude. He goes, what are you studying? I said, I'm a theater major. And he said, oh, wow, you have a headshot or something? I'll give it to my manager. You know, just a nice thought. I go, actually, no, I don't have that. But I want you to know I've thought about doing stand-up before, but I didn't know there were ways to do it like this. And he goes, yeah, dude. I said, I really think I want to try this. And he says, well, what's holding you back? Why don't you go for it? We can always use other comedians. And I go, yeah. And I turn around and I have the walk home of that. We all have that epiphany. Like, I may be able to do this. I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know that was an option. I thought
you
it
just
was.
Saw, you saw it on TV.
Yes.
And it's a guy
with a microphone
in front of a brick
and
wall.
And a sport coat with
who's
the sleeves
going,
rolled
what's
up.
With these people?
Yes, exactly.
Anybody ever do this? You have cheese.
Which I love.
Yeah, that's fine.
Such a great respect for that. And I say, okay. And I make this long walk home and I'm thinking through the thing. And I say, okay, that's maybe this is something I can do. And then we get to the Romeo and Juliet. I'm not cast in it. I have a tiny part of Peter. People don't remember Peter, but this is my part. I'm going to reenact it for you. Madam, the guests have come. That's it.
I was great in that. I heard. I was not at that particular production.
Well, I have a t-shirt for you.
But yeah.
And I told my acting coach, I'm not doing anything. There's a stand-up competition in the school paper. And he said, you got to do that. And so I write for 3 days, you know, doing prop stuff is what I've always done since a kid. Enter the competition. I was like, oh, Lord, let me go first or last. I don't want to be in the middle. I want to see everybody's act, and then I want to be last. Turns out I draw 13, last spot. I go up on the same stage that Carrot Top had been on. This is probably five, maybe 6 months later, if that. And I kill. I kill at just stuff I had written around the house and little pieces of with character nuances that I'd done on stage. And I won. And first place was an audition at the Birmingham Comedy Club with Bruce Ayers. Are you familiar with Bruce?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And that was, I drove to Birmingham, got on stage with Bruce, did 5 minutes of silly, goofy stuff. He came off stage, said, come with me, took me to his office, this college kid, and said, I've never seen anyone do what you're doing. You can work the rest of your life if you want to do that, making people laugh and getting paid for it. And I go, what? Yeah, you can work the rest of your life. And that's how I started doing stand-up. Was that night I went back home, I went back to school, graduated with a theater degree, and got on the road. That was it.
In your face, Uta Hagen.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, put that on your poodle's sweater. Well, that's an amazing thing to get a BFA in theater from Baylor University and head right
Auburn.
Pardon me, Auburn. I'm sorry. Where's Baylor's down there?
Baylor's in California, isn't it?
No.
Texas.
But Texas, yes. Sorry.
Yes.
Texas is so big that I was intimidated.
We have parts of Texas and Alabama, so it's fine.
You're in Texas right now. Back up.
My apologies. Yeah, Auburn. I know you. No, I know you guys are very, you know, very weird with that.
Right.
With that stuff. No, who's Auburn? No, Auburn's Auburn is very competitive with Alabama. With Alabama, of course.
Right.
Of course. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Southern University trivia. I'm not going to any bars for that competition with the
don't
computers.
Do it.
I don't know a thing about it. So you get out of Auburn University, the yes. Auburn Tigers.
Right.
What was the Tigers' name at Auburn?
Aubie. Right.
But you never got to be Aubie.
No, never. Started doing.
But you started doing stand up.
Doing one night.
So what? Like right? Yeah. I mean, right out of Auburn.
The week I graduated.
Thank you for my sheepskin here in theater.
I didn't even walk. I had to mail it to me because I was given a gig.
That's always the thing.
Yeah.
Always. Everyone I know, the great musicians actually don't get their diploma because they're doing gigs with the professors they're working with. You know, the actors can't, well, I can't continue. Well, why? Because I'm working right. as an actor. Right. I got this thing and I can't go to the class now.
Yes. They've mailed my diploma to me. I didn't get up there and go, I'm graduating, Heath Heitch. I didn't get that. I went home.
So right out of college, you're working in comedy clubs.
At the Birmingham Club, which had, in the meantime, when I was at school, and I said, okay, this is going to work. I'm going to be a stand-up comic. The Birmingham Comedy Club in a snowstorm burned down. Do you remember this story?
I do remember that.
With Carrot Top's entire act in it, ironically.
That's right.
So he was on the Tonight Show that Monday, and on a Saturday it burned down. His first Tonight Show. So he had to rebuild everything from scratch.
You know, In 2 days.
Yeah. Well, he had to postpone and do it three weeks later. But the club had burned down, so I'm about to graduate. Like, yeah. Oh, are you kidding me? Like, the one club I'm okay to work at just burned to the ground. Months later, you know, I graduate. I go to the new opening of the Stardome, which is a beautiful
Stardome is a very big and club. It's a very, very nicely put together where the audience is kind of – it's a very strong rake, which if people don't know that, it's like it's tilted so everyone gets a very good view of the stage.
Well, it used to be a dinner theater. And he
I didn't know that.
So there you can see it now. Like you would have the tables and you want everyone to see the productions.
Very
and
big
the
lights, stage.
Huge stage. And so I go to him after he opens this club and he says, all right. Next week, or in 2 weeks, Tommy Chong is coming. You're going to be his opening act. I need you to do 5 minutes of clean material, and this is going to be you hosting the show. I don't know what that means. You know, only host I know is Kermit the Frog. You know, I said, yay! And so I say, okay, I can do that. And I just put together an act and start, you know, open for Tommy Chong. And I thought, I have made it.
So really your first professional gig, opening for Tommy Chong.
5 minutes in front of Tommy Chong. At the Stardome. I was so lucky to be the right people saw me at the right exact time when I needed the right thing to happen, you know. So
you were hosting at the Stardome for a long time then?
Yes.
They were starting to really work and do the 5 minutes?
Five. And then they said, Bruce Ayers, who is like, he has been made so much in my career of what has happened because he was the manager of the club and also later became my manager to book me on the road and said, okay, this 5 minutes is great. That's not going to work where you're going with that. But next, you need 7 minutes. Next week or whatever. Right. And kind of pushed me along in that. And I would build things and bring them in and things wouldn't work. You know, things would bomb or things just wouldn't, because that's not what is you. Pulling stuff out of a trunk or whatever, you are different than that. You're a character. You're a sketch comedy guy.
Yeah, so early on, you were your props, your building things was the, that was what it was about, you thought.
I did. I
said, and he was trying to communicate to you, Keith, it's really you.
Yeah, right.
And you're helped by the props, but you're not, it's not Carrot Top.
Right.
You're not building the thing and saying, look at this thing.
Yes, right.
You know, you are actually acting
and
being supported by the things that you have built.
Yes. And he said, just keep thinking outside the box. He said, don't think of, this is the suitcase I have and everything has to fit in here. And that was the best lesson. He said, because I build everything myself. He said, don't think it has to fit in that. He said, I don't care. We'll get it there. He was, whatever it is, we can get it to wherever you need it to be. And that opened my brain as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, the Stardome Comedy Club, it's a 40-foot by 40-foot stage with 40-foot ceilings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was building things.
You could build big stuff, right?
And then, you know, later in your opening career, you get to MC at Chattanooga Comedy Catch, which is a crate in the corner with a microphone stand. And I said, I don't know what. I called Bruce from the club, true story, and said, they don't even have a follow spot. That's what I said. I was like, what club doesn't have a follow spot? And he loves that. He loves that story.
Oh, as I've said here and to Fred, you know, I played the tuba because I was a tuba player very early on in my act. And there's a club, the Bijou Cafe in Philadelphia, where I was opening for some jazz fusion, Spyro Gyra, whatever. And I get there, and they show me the stage. And I literally have a 1 foot by 1 foot square.
Right.
That's to stand in. And everything else is keyboards and drum sets and cymbals.
I know.
And they're like, don't disturb any of the instruments on stage.
Yes. Right.
Just go up. And literally, it was a box that you couldn't move your feet.
You
couldn't walk around. You just had to stand in this square.
Right.
Talking about being in marching band and doing all this kind of physical stuff. So, but I'm just... talk about certainly for you building giant appliances which are helping these sketches that you're doing, and you come to a new place just with your fingers crossed.
Yeah, we don't know where you're going to put that. That was the kind of the reaction. Like, can you do it without that? And in your brain, as a comic, we go, no, this is the show. This is what I do. So
I played this tuba in coffee houses literally on my knees.
Oh.
Because it was the ceiling was so low. And I'm tall that the horn would just hit the it would hit the ceiling.
Right.
I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So I would come up on stage kneeling down.
Oh.
In order to play.
I've done
you know, taking the mic stand all the way down.
Right.
I did that at John and Peter's in New Hope, Pennsylvania. A number of places.
Yeah.
But it's just how you have to get into the place, you know, walk in, look at everything and say, oh no. I'm in trouble here. And then just start changing things.
Yes. I know. That's how, and I would say, okay, I can move table six. That can be, because I carry a little, what I would call a Japanese dress blind that I go behind to change clothes and change costumes. Mm-hmm. I say, I'll move table six. That'll be my area there. This table 13 over here, we just have to take that out because I've got to set stuff over there. And clubs are usually cool about it because I'm changing everything they've seen.
Right.
You know, every type of stand-up, I'm doing something so different.
So what was your... Early on,
right.
You start working and you're doing 5 minutes and seven.
Yes.
But what was your approach? Was it did you have a voice, a personality that you were trying to project, as many comedians do? Or were you just thinking, why don't I have a steam engine on stage? And could I run from it? Or would it be funnier? Was that the kind of thing you were thinking?
Somewhat. I would... A lot of my writing, I'm so different. I'll go to a thrift store, a flea market, and I'll walk around, and I will see something, and I will say, oh, look at this Civil War handcuffs or something, some old Western handcuffs that they would put a bandit in. And then my brain says, what if I did a bandit who's tied up, and it starts rolling like that. And then the guy, we have sound effects of a train coming, and we don't know if he's on the train or about to be thrown off the train, whatever the bit is. That's how I would write or approach things.
And you would think as a comedian, very Red Skelton-esque, is the comedy will come from a handcuffed guy knowing that a train is coming.
Or whatever.
How do I get out of these handcuffs? How do I escape this because it's coming at me?
And what do I add to it? Like, do I add the handcuffs or do I have a – I've even built mouse traps under a poncho to do a – Old West sketch, the mouse traps are hooked to sticks that have dowels on them that are arrows, and I pull the mouse traps and they come up and hit
me in
the chest.
Oh, so the mouse trap actually springs under a poncho.
And fires an arrow into my chest.
And it's like an arrow going into your chest.
And I would do it like, here we go! You know, and I would go down and come back up, and I had about six or seven arrows that would, during time of the music... I just thought it would be funny to do that. And, of course, I don't use it in my show now because it doesn't have a payoff. It's just, wow, those arrows look great. And then you have to take that silence of taking the arrow poncho off and, like, I don't even have a...
Well, as you well know, or Eddie, you know, when you go for the big bit or something that you've built or even a verbal joke that you know it's going to take a while for this to pay off... man, it has to pay off.
Yes.
Oh. Because if you wait, that minute that they're sitting there, and they're giving you the benefit of the doubt, going, right. I'm sure this is going to be good.
The first stuff was great. Yeah.
Well, this is, I mean, he's very funny.
The knees on the tuba was fantastic.
Right. So I'm sure, whatever this it's just, and you're just like, well, yeah. Okay, I guess let's all just move on to the next thing.
Right. My worst moment of that, my brain, I say, what a great idea to have a character of a little boy in a bubble bath. Now, this happens to be before Mike Myers did his famous little bubble bath sketch on Saturday Night. So it was before that. So I build a cardboard facade of a bubble bath. I work weeks on it. It looks – I'm shading it like theater paint I've learned. I have bubbles on translucent fabric that are bubbling over the side. I have a bubble machine inside it that the bubbles come up. And I say, what I'm going to do is I write a couple of little jokes. I have a rubber ducky on a spring stick that looks like it's floating in the bathtub. The music's going to come on. Splish, splash, I was taking a bath. And I set this up for the forced perspective of the audience. I duck behind it, take off my shirt, and pop up in the bathtub as a little boy, and I'm going to tell a story. The visual, Tom, destroys. I go, yes! And they go, we've never seen anything. laughing in the music. And I'm sitting in this bathtub on stage with my shirt off, and I say, I didn't write enough. You know, that's when I realized, okay, all right, what am I going to do to get out of this? There's no ending to it except standing up, gently folding the bathtub, and putting my shirt back on.
Let me put my shirt back on, folks.
In
thanks.
Dead silence.
Thanks for enjoying this incredible visual aid that I've made of a kid in a bathtub.
And so much that the comic after me did a joke that kind of bombed, and he said, hey, at least I'm not up here in a bathtub.
Yeah.
And got a huge laugh of it.
Did you dump the bathtub?
Oh, of course.
You didn't do it.
No bathtub. No more bathtub. Tons of those. Tons of bathtub stories. Tons of bathtub stories.
So through this, how many years have you been doing stand-up now?
I started working professionally, I guess. My first check was in 1993, so almost 20 years.
So 20 years.
Yeah, I know. I just realized that. Yeah. I just realized that.
And great success.
Yeah, as well, success.
I think pretty good success, buddy.
Get your picture
when
on
you're,
there.
You know, when they're going, when a lot of people are going to the big places to look at comedy with, you know, as I say, not cheap drinks and good food, and they're out for the weekend, and hey, it better be good because it's not cheap and it's not easy to go get in your car and go to the places.
Yeah.
And your picture's on the wall.
It's been so much fun.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Now, through it all, have you ever thought of not doing it?
Yes, I did. I've gone through
things. When did it get difficult and you thought, I'm not sure this is a go?
Tuesday. No.
Really? Wow.
No, you know, when you and we've all done this. I've started, you know, booking myself. You have to call the clubs and email the clubs and hope that the right person gets the email. And when you know there's a relationship with these bookers or whoever they are, and you reach out to them and you don't hear back, you're saying, wow, I thought that was going to be a lot different. I thought I was going to immediately hear back. So sometimes with that, I say, is it worth it? But when you're on stage and you're doing your thing, or even, Tom, I'll tell you, working at the Comedy Store up here on Sunset, love the room. I've been there forever. I took a hiatus for years from like 2002 till this past February. I just stopped doing it because it was a little depressing there sometimes.
The Comedy Store?
Yes.
I've been on a hiatus since 1991.
Okay, so you get
until now.
But I
worked there very, very frequently, like 7 nights a week from 81 to 91.
So you totally get it.
And now we're on hiatus.
Yes, okay. So
91 to now.
Gotcha. So going back up, saying, I'm going to go back. And I wanted to have that same energy of going back and feeling that crowd and knowing how I used to destroy. But the audiences have kind of changed. And when you are... When they say that cliche, hipper than the room, that's how I kind of feel now. And I go, you start second guessing yourself. Am I not hip enough? Am I doing stuff that no one wants to see? Do people want to still see me? That's when it gets me. You know, at night when you say you're only as good as your last show, I guess. So
I don't have that.
Oh, okay.
I just am a sheer ego. No, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But it still works, though.
Oh, it does.
It just doesn't work for depressed people on Sunset Boulevard.
And you got to remember that. And that's the hardest thing because I say, as you do, I know, or maybe you've passed this, but you want to say, I know you will find this funny if you trust me and follow me with this. It's funny, I promise, people. That's how I feel.
Here is a question that I have, and I don't even know how to word it. But because your act is very theatrical,
yes,
and visual, and using these using props, but as I say, as the helping for a sketch,
right, right,
has a culture and an audience increasingly attached not only to itself, to its own kind of narcissism, but to its phone.
Right.
Has that affected the extent to which people will reach toward you? Do you know what? Did I make sense with the question?
You mean with this digital age or this?
Yes, the digital age and an audience that really, it's, you know, everyone's talking about niche audiences, right, and you have to find your niche, the people who like you or like what you're about, because that's how people are deciding things now. I'm going to go onto the internet and things, and I'm going to decide the slice of pie that I will follow in my life. So you as performers, writers, anything, you know, symphony orchestras have to find the people that are into that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you find yourself at the slice of pie that is not your slice of pie, you know, people can just say, well, it might be good, but I'm just not, you know, I'm not willing to extend myself into waiting to see the bathtub or what the kid in the bathtub says.
Yeah. That's, yes, I felt that way a lot in the past years. And then something really cool happened. I started working on Disney Cruise Lines. And I had shunned cruise line work for years and said, I'm not going to do this. I don't want to be – there's nothing wrong with it. But I was like, I don't want to be a cruise line comic, because I had a vision, like I did when I first started stand-up, that you had to have – a stand-up comic had to have a sport coat on and a microphone. I had a vision of – the stand-up comics on a cruise ship to be like the I Love Lucy episode. Right. You know,
hey, anybody here from Buffalo?
Yeah.
Anybody here from Normal Parents? Oh, pritch. But I know, you know, folks, that's the buffet today was, you know.
And I go, I just try it, and it was so creative. The energy of a huge stage and a huge audience and being able to create, and these people loved what I was doing. They were like, this is great. This is phenomenal. Like, we've never seen anything like this, because they've never been to a comedy club. Mm. And they've seen jugglers and magicians, and they've seen mentalists, and they've seen these on the ship, but they've never seen anybody actually doing, I think, comedy with a different take, with a sketch comedy, a live, one-man, high-energy character
at a
sketch comedy.
At a very big professional theater.
Yes, and I was like, this is it. So it put a fire in me to write like a family show, to make sure that, because they have kids in the audience, mm-hmm, obviously it's a Disney ship, mm-hmm, and I almost wrote an hour's worth of new material. Now, granted, I can't do it at the Hermosa Beach Comedy Magic Club or at the, you know, Stardom. Some of it I could do Stardom, because a lot of it's Disney related or things like that, but it was creative.
Oh, so you're specifically like writing things with that in mind?
Yes.
Oh.
With trying to say, what would, if I were on a cruise and I am 9 years old, what am I going to say, Mom, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not dumbing down my show. I'm bringing the adults along with it. And it was really fun. It was a great exercise. And now I've got a family show that when I go to comedy clubs, I say, if you want it, we can do a matinee, all ages, and the adults aren't going to be bored. It's not a kiddie show, but they're going to love it, guaranteed. So some of the clubs, I book that along Christmas time, and I do a Christmas version of it, which, you know, a lot of fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's you know, what's in the future? What are you working on? You're still the guy making stuff in your basement?
Right in the garage, right outside on the driveway.
Really?
I've got all my tools, workshopping things. I'm going to go do – have you ever been to Hilarities in Cleveland?
I have.
I'm going there next – in 2 weeks on the June 20th through the 24th.
At Pickwick and Frolic, downtown in Cleveland.
Which is another stage that I see. I go,
it's a great stage.
This is perfect for me.
It's a wonderful venue.
Doing that. And then in August, we're actually, my girl and I are going up to Sonoma, California, August 3rd and 4th to do it's a family Broadway Under the Stars in the Jack London Park underneath the ruins of the winery that was there. So it's like this outdoor thing where they have all these Broadway kids come and sing, and they said, do you want to do some stand-up? So I'm going to do my family show outside under the stars. I've never done this. So it's a family night of Broadway.
Jack London Park. You could do a White Fang.
Yes.
Okay? He's like, just bring up a dog.
Yeah, see, that's what I do. In a bathtub.
Well, Heath, I've always, you know, I've always admired what you do. I've always admired, so admired.
Well, it's you too. Me with you. Like, I'm telling you, Tom, when you tell me things, and we would talk in the green room that time about when I'd heard this story about the wagon trains and the Western Tom's.
Oh,
Western
that
show.
I did. Yeah, the Cowboy Tommy show.
That was Cowboy Tommy is my jealous use. I was furiously happy for you. You know, like you go, oh, that's a great idea. I love that part of you. And I've told people when they say, who would be good for you? I said, people that would want to watch my show and say, no, take that, move that I would trust are people like, you know, Charlie Varicola?
Sure.
Because he works a lot with Scott and Carrot Top. I would trust Carrot Top. I would trust Tom. I would trust you to watch what I do and say, Heath, I see what you're doing, but you're wrong. And that's hard to do with what we do, is to have someone be able to tell you, you're wrong on this. I would also trust, Louis Anderson is a great guy like that, that can see. He said, you've got to have someone that gets you. To watch you, to enjoy you. And I think that those are my top four or five guys.
I love shows, and I even love shows that I've done. And for people who don't know, I did a one-man show, a big theatrical show called Cowboy Tommy, kind of a Wild West show.
Brilliant.
In a theater with me as Cowboy Tommy, the biggest, fastest, happiest singing cowboy in America.
I love
where
it.
I had was doing whip tricks and roping people, all kinds of stuff. I brought a girl in the audience, and we had a whole wagon train thing. We acted a scene together. I just gave her a script, and it was a lot of fun. I think the thing I love most about it, maybe that you've experienced in your show, was when I was working on that show, at least a third of the audience walked out.
Oh.
Here's the thing.
Right.
And that was just absolutely soul-crushing to me.
Yes, of course.
Another third of the audience brought back eight people on the weekend.
Yeah, great.
And said, I saw this thing.
Yeah.
And I don't really even know what it is.
Absolutely.
But you just have to see it.
Yes. Yes.
You know, to experience it. It was just theatrical.
Yeah.
And it was just big and crazy. Mm-hmm. And just, what if I just went crazy?
Yeah. I love that. I love that. And the other people that do that, that when I feel that I've done my job well, and you'll understand this, and we'll probably have to explain it, is when the wait staff come back on Sunday night on their day off.
That's true. That when is the biggest. And I've said that to so many waitresses and waiters and managers and everything. The biggest compliment in comedy is for these grizzled veterans of seeing everybody. And their day off is Sunday night, and they come to your show.
Yeah.
Because they really enjoyed it in the pieces that they saw, but they were working serving drinks. So they thought, boy, everyone was like, and I just
their
had to come back.
Wives
I brought my, I brought my everybody Mom, to see this thing.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
That's my favorite compliment. Is that I always used to do a bit about when they would tell me this, that there's a cigarette hanging out and they're wiping the tables down. I see a lot of people, but you are different. You know, like that. They have to sit there wiping the tables. We're coming back Sunday. I just love that. I love that there's that. It makes me feel like, okay, I am doing something. I am doing something different and fun that these veterans.
You sure are. Where's a website that people can find you?
TheHeathShow.com.
TheHeath, H-E-A-T-H, show.com.
Yes.
And are you on everything?
Twitter and Facebook, all of those things, and the same handle, The Heath Show, trying to do the Twitter. I don't know how to tweet it.
No, I really don't either.
I have no idea. Well, I have no idea.
Heath, I'm a fan, and I thank you so much.
You're such an inspiration. And I mean, I know everyone tries to say things, but you are such an inspiration because you do different, and I love it. I love it.
Yeah,
I really do.
I always thought, I'm just going to do whatever I think is funny.
Yes. That's such a great...
And then fortunately, the people who agree with you come.
And a lot of times people don't know this, and if you're listening out there, that's a big if. When people mention your name and they say, you won't meet a nicer, more giving guy as far as... Everybody says that about you. And
not background artists.
Was that?
Not background artists. because of the post-it note.
Right, thing. I know. But they love you, and I think you're great. I mean, everyone says you got to see it. You got to see it.
Thanks, buddy.
Yes.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Awesome.
My pleasure.
Yes.
The Heath Show, H-E-A-T-H show, is his website. So check Heath out and see where he's coming to be near you. And go see him. It's a different...
a comedy experience, but you're going to have a lot of fun. You're going to have a lot of fun. Thanks so much, Heath, for being my guest on the podcast. And thank you. Thanks for listening. If you haven't subscribed, please consider subscribing. Please tell a friend. I'm really amazed and gratified by the feedback I'm getting. I'm glad people are enjoying it. So thanks. Thanks, Emily Wilson, for producing. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody at Nerdist, for helping me out. Thanks to McPherson Guitars and Dean Markley Strings for helping me with the live show. Keep listening, and we'll talk to you again. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.